This is Games as a Podcast.
Hey, Ethan. How are you?
Good, Chris. How you doing?
Doing fine, thanks. Just fine.
Well, I would hope so, because next week is the launch of Switch 2, and that is maybe one of the three most exciting days of the year for me.
Yes. Who knows when this episode will air, but current Ethan and Chris, as of this recording, are very excited to see next week come.
Yeah. Lots of good Sega stuff, too. We got Yakuza Zero Director's Cut coming.
Mm-hmm.
Puyo Tetris, another version of Sonic Generations. And I'm planning on picking up all of those.
I would expect nothing less from you. I'm also looking forward to checking out some of the Sega stable on the new platform.
And of course, I'm sure we're going to be playing plenty of Mario Kart against each other as well.
Yes, that I cannot wait. It's been so long in coming. I look forward to getting my skills dialed in so that I can battle my nieces and represent the old folks well.
Yep. Well, so actually one other game I was playing that got me really thinking about what we're ultimately going to be talking about for this episode. I've been playing Sonic Colors on Nintendo Switch.
Mm.
And it's a really good adaptation. Again, the load times are a little longer than if you're playing on PS5. But still, it's just so weird that I'm playing a Sonic game, even today, on a Nintendo platform. It feels like that shouldn't be possible, right? That's the only way you can access Sonic games is to play it on Sega hardware. But of course, we're long past that.
Yes, long, long.
Yes, but I thought that it would be interesting to just look at the history of Nintendo and Sega, where they started out as pretty bitter enemies,
yeah,
and ended up becoming really tight-knit allies in terms of kids' games and family entertainment. And it's really remarkable how they've benefited each other in these more recent years, to the point where Sonic games in particular always sell best on Nintendo hardware.
Yep.
So they'll put it on everything, but Nintendo is really where that audience is.
For sure. I think there's great brand affinity between some of Sega's IP and Nintendo now, which is kind of ironic because I think they kind of started in opposite ends of the spectrum, and that is where Sega carved out their niche, or rather large niche, but where they position themselves in the market as compared to Nintendo as being a little bolder, being a little more edgier, quote-unquote, and offering something a bit different than the average Nintendo experience or game.
Well, my very first game that I worked on when I was at Sega was Sonic Heroes.
Oh, yeah.
And the lead SKU was the Nintendo GameCube one. That's the mm-hmm. one that ran the best between Xbox, PlayStation 2, and GameCube. And we were also right in that period working on Phantasy Star Online Episode 3, the card game, mm-hmm. which is a weird one, and one of the few games to use the adapter for online that
yep.
we made. And so it's interesting to look back and think that when you were at Sega in your first year, you were still working on Dreamcast. They hadn't made that transition yet.
Yep.
Can you give us any kind of inside scoop as to what the vibe at Sega was about Nintendo?
Oh, it's interesting. I think there's probably certainly respect for the brands and for just the heritage that Nintendo had. But honestly, we were so focused on the Dreamcast, you didn't really have time to think about the competition so much as just what you were doing on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis just to get stuff out. So I think certainly the marketing team, the marketing department thought a lot about positioning against the competition. But for me, day-to-day, it was more about how best to represent the titles and the platform that we were shipping. So it was definitely, personally for me, less about opposition to Nintendo and more just executing to a high degree to best represent the stuff that we had that was coming and out.
I can totally see that. And it makes sense because the approach that Sega was taking at the time was very different, highly differentiated from what anyone else was doing. So comparisons might be harder.
Yeah, for sure. We've touched on this before. But there was a lot of education that Sega did or had to do shipping a console with internet in the box. So that was kind of a foreign concept to a lot of console gamers, the fact that you could go online and play against other humans. Certainly not unheard of in gaming at large with PC gaming, of course. But console gamers tend to be a little more mass market, especially back then. And there was a lot of work, a lot of energy devoted towards educating the consumer, educating the gamers out there how to get their Dreamcast online, and some of the nuances and the challenges of hooking up this box to a phone line and dialing up into an ISP and getting online. So certainly very challenging, completely different than a Nintendo versus Sega type battle.
Sure. And though at the same time, once Sega did divest itself of the hardware business and was fully in on software, focusing on bringing the best possible experiences to the different platforms really did come to the fore. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget a time where, as a very new employee, I did what probably was more brazen than I thought it was at the time. And I was still following religiously the magazines. And Electronic Gaming Monthly had noted that Sega's going to be the next Rockstar Games because we had this bench of incredibly valuable intellectual property and we were bringing it to all platforms and that we are going to be a major player. And when I saw that quote, I took the magazine and I walked into Surumi-san's office, the head of Sega of America at the time, and I dropped it on his desk, and he was in a call, but I just quietly dropped it on his desk and pointed to it and walked away. And later in the day, he came up to me and patted me on the back at my desk. He found where I sat and patted me on the back and said, "This is very good, very good." And he sent out an email, and he had written down like what the article said and captured that and shared it with the rest of the company. So he was very excited about people talking in those terms about Sega at that time.
For sure. And to Sega's benefit, there was a pretty large stable of game journalists that were kind of on Sega's side. They appreciated that kind of underdog story, had fond memories of Sega, and wanted Sega to succeed. So I think seeing those articles was a lot of projection of wishes based on their own fond memories of playing the Sega consoles of yore.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's interesting then, again, in particular, seeing these games on the GameCube. I remember the first time I ever saw a game from Sega running on GameCube was when I was at the launch party for the Nintendo GameCube and seeing Super Monkey Ball and Sonic Adventure Battle 2. And it was just crazy to see those games running. And it looked pretty clear to me that Sega really was the most important third party at the launch of GameCube. Because you had Luigi's Mansion, which was a big deal. You had the Star Wars Rogue Squadron. But after that, it was Super Monkey Ball. And then a month after, the Sonic game came out. And it was a huge seller. It dramatically outsold the Dreamcast version that it was originally built for.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was kind of, I want to say surprising, but not surprising at the same time. The first time I played Monkey Ball on the GameCube, it was weird and surreal because it's a Sega IP, Sega property, but it felt so natural on the GameCube, and testament to the team producing a really very polished title for the console. And then also I think underscores the affinity those Sega IPs and brands have with the kind of Nintendo brand. And again, kind of ironic that Sonic, who was positioned to be this competitor to Mario, evolved to be something that was very simpatico with the Nintendo platform, Nintendo brand.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk a bit about how that really came to its natural zenith with the Sonic and Mario at the Olympics. Mm-hmm. Because I remember sitting down at the company meeting where it was announced we were actually doing this, and so many things came out of that. One of the big things was, why an Olympics game? Because to me and so many other people, if we're doing a Sonic and a Mario game, wouldn't it make more sense? Wouldn't it be even more attractive to do an action platform mm-hmm. game?
Yeah, you'd think so, based on the heritage of the particular parties in question.
Yes. But what I found interesting was a lot of it was just tied to Nintendo really loving the IOC and the Olympics committee and wanting to do something with Olympics. And we had to create both the Mario and Sonic game and an official Olympics game. Yeah. And we knew no one would really care about that official Olympics game. Those games never sell very well. But yeah. we put our top team members on it to make sure that it was high quality. And it was. It was a very good-looking game, good-playing game that didn't sell very well, the vanilla Olympics game. But the real deal was the Sonic and Mario at the Olympics, and that thing sold better than just about anything I think I ever saw in my time at Sega, anyway.
Definitely the highest-selling Olympics-based game, I would say. And maybe somewhere someone at Nintendo is like, well, let's just stick it to Sega a little bit on, just to give them a complete headache in terms of a project management perspective, just having all those parties and all those brand managers have a stake in all the approvals. I feel for the production folks who had to get that all done, because I can only imagine all of the hurdles and meetings and headaches just to get that title shipped, just involving so many IPs.
And to get it done on time.
Yeah.
On a really tight schedule, because you can't do the game and delay it 3 months past the Olympics.
No, it had to ship on time. Pretty much like a movie tie-in type game, but with the added drama of having all the Nintendo IP to contend with, the IOC, who's no fun to deal with from a approvals process.
No, that's right.
And then all of Sega's IP as well. So you didn't have, it wasn't just Sonic and just Mario. It was this nice melange of IP approval pain.
And then the difficulty of making sure that you could have a fun pick-up-and-play multiplayer game that felt as fluid as hopefully something like Wii Sports,
mm-hmm.
because that's what people were used to. And that's very hard to do when you're trying to make it feel like it's also following the rules of these official sports.
Yes, and also playing to the strengths of the characteristics of those specific characters. So I think in a lot of ways a party game made sense, because the feel of a Mario game is very different than the feel of a Sonic game. So to create this kind of neutral territory, for lack of a better word, made a lot of sense, that allowed them to cross-pollinate and compete.
Yeah. And again, ultimately, I think people were pretty happy with the experience, and certainly they did a number of additional games. I remember in the mobile world, we did for a very brief period of time a Sonic at the Olympics game, because we didn't have the Nintendo license there. And
Nintendo was not on mobile at that point, yeah.
Right. So that was kind of an interesting variation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's something that actually happened, and I, to this day, wish they had followed up with an action platform game. But I don't know how that would work, because, of course, Sonic is about speed and Mario is about just kind of puzzle action platforming that is much slower paced. So maybe they were smart not to go down that direction. But still, we saw plenty of Sega games then on Nintendo hardware, and not just Sonic, but Samba de Amigo eventually mm-hmm. came over.
Definitely.
And for the Wii, that was a perfect fit. The Switch game is actually quite good, too. There was, finally, we're getting the Yakuza games. Mm-hmm. So Yakuza Kiwami came over, and we're getting, as I said before, Yakuza 0 for the Switch 2. One of the interesting ones was the Sonic Chronicles game, the BioWare RPG mm-hmm. that was Sonic-focused only on Nintendo DS. And that was a really interesting take with physical action gameplay that was still turn-based, mm-hmm. But you had to do things with the touchscreen to pull off your moves. And it had a really deep storyline. And again, just interesting that that came out just on Nintendo hardware. But what would you say were your favorite Sega games on Nintendo?
Well, I have a soft spot for Monkey Ball just because it was the first, and I thought it was such a faithful arcade port. At all the mini games, you have a really fun multiplayer type situation, so that is near and dear to my heart. Phantasy Star, I think, was really well. Phantasy Star Online specifically was well executed on the GameCube. Certainly had challenges with the modem not being a baked in thing, but was still, I think, well done and found a pretty good audience. another thing I wanted to talk about was seeing Sega IP percolate into Nintendo titles. So specifically the introduction of Sonic and Friends and Smash Brothers, I thought was pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. Certainly game IP from all over the place found its way into the series just because it's a force of nature. But it's kind of cool to see Sonic and Friends, and then Joker from Persona and Bayonetta, who's not technically Sega owned but very affiliated to Sega, made their way into the games as well, which was pretty awesome to see, I think.
Yeah, and of course Sonic is one of the most popular characters in Smash Brothers.
That is S tier for sure.
Yeah. And Bayonetta also is a really interesting one, because I remember when the first Bayonetta came out, Maeda-san, who was the president of Sega at the time, had done a handshake deal with Platinum to make that game happen. And there was a lot of concern about whether or not it would be successful, because it did really feel like a non-Western experience, and that there's an audience for that, but it's not a huge audience. And sure enough, when that game came out, it came out the same week as Darksiders from THQ, and they just handed us our ass. I mean, it's like, you know, Bayonetta was the better game, I think, no doubt. But Darksiders was no slouch, and Darksiders was kind of a Blizzard aesthetic tied to a Zelda gameplay. Mm-hmm. And that's what players really wanted, and so we didn't sell as many copies of Bayonetta as we would have liked. And so inevitably, when Bayonetta 2 came around, which we were all very excited about internally, but also recognized that it was a fraught situation because we already knew that it was hard to sell. We started moving forward on it, and there were all sorts of interesting ideas on how to get better visibility for it in the West. But if you remember, ultimately, that game went over to Nintendo. We were in a position where we were trying to figure out what to do with it, and Nintendo came along and just paid for the whole thing, and it became a Nintendo release on the Wii U, of all things.
Yeah, strange. Not what I would call a great match for the demographic, but interesting.
Yeah, and it also ensured that the game did survive, that it got completed, and in fact, we got a Bayonetta 3. But Bayonetta 1 I love. Bayonetta 2, I think, is the best in the series. And so it's just really cool when I pop that game in, because the opening sequence is so great, where she's fighting on fighter jets, and it's just so ridiculous and over the top. But you see the Nintendo brand pop up, and you see the Sega logo pop up. Yeah. And this game is just pure art. It's like aggressively art house gaming, right? Mm-hmm. And I just love it for that. And I love that it has both of those brands in there. So it just shows that there, at that point, was a level of trust and respect between the two studios to where we could get those things done. And yeah, it's really cool to celebrate that in Smash Brothers as well.
Yeah, I also have a special place for Sonic Advance, which was on the Game Boy Advance, GBA. Such a high-quality game. Very surreal to see Sonic on a Nintendo platform or just even a non-Sega platform, but it was such a great game. I think it really helped pave the way to deeper relationship between the two companies, and also help gamers make that transition from Sega as being this kind of monolithic console IP company into something that is percolating all its IP out to other platforms.
Yeah, that's true. And there was that kind of mental switch. One of the things I found most interesting about Sega's approach to third-party publishing was that they were not just taking their games and putting it on every single platform.
Yeah, they were very thoughtful. Yeah.
They knew that there was a different audience for Xbox versus GameCube versus PlayStation 2. Mm-hmm. So PlayStation 2 got Virtual Fighter 4, which I remember was getting tens across the board. People were really excited. Fantastic, to see that. Dude. Great game, but not on GameCube.
Yep.
Where Billy Hatcher was on GameCube, but not on PlayStation or Xbox.
Mm-hmm.
And Xbox was the first to get Shenmue 2.
Yep.
So they were just, again, really thoughtful with those exclusives. I'm sure there was probably some exclusivity deals for these as well to sew them
for
up.
For sure.
Because remember, like, how exciting it was that there was going to be a new Panzer Dragoon and a new Jet Set on Xbox.
Yep.
But really interesting to look at for Nintendo, they clearly saw it as a place where younger audiences would play. So you had the Super Monkey Balls, you had the Sonics, the Billy Hatchers. That's really what they focus on. Amazing Island, if you remember that one.
Yep.
We did get the Phantasy Star games, as you mentioned. And actually, I was hardcore enough to where I begged a friend of mine who was visiting Japan to pick up one of those ridiculous-looking GameCube controllers with a full keyboard.
Oh, yeah. I remember this.
And it was really neat, except I forgot about the fact that I still would be the only person playing that had that thing. So it didn't allow for any meaningful conversation at all. It just meant that I could be a chatterbox and everyone else would be
very, very one-sided like conversations, I imagine.
Yes, yes. So, but it was such a crazy time. And again, the broadband adapter for the GameCube, I think it was just made for our games alone. Because I don't remember any other third-party or first-party games that used it. I know that some people would use it for LAN parties for Mario Kart.
Yeah.
But that was not an online thing.
Yeah.
Kind of crazy. Again, you wouldn't see that nowadays, an entire hardware peripheral put together for one publisher.
Yeah, it kind of speaks to Sega's technological, I guess, advances, or kind of being a leading-edge technology company. Plus a game company. Nintendo, I think, was polar opposite, very content to not focus so much on the technical side of things and focus more on the gameplay and delivering a very solid game experience. Not that Sega didn't focus on those things also, but Nintendo has definitely always been behind in terms of offering online functionality, robust internet gameplay, and even their consoles are not pushing the boundaries of technology. Instead, they focus on unique interactions that the players have with the console. So the DS, with the touch screens, the dual screens, the Switch being obviously portable and a console at the same time. So they innovated in different ways that weren't necessarily pushing the technology, but innovative still.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, with Sonic in particular, we really saw a lot of exclusive games for Nintendo. So he would appear on the Xbox and PlayStation, but very often, like when we were in the era of Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3, the Wii couldn't keep up with it. So when there was Sonic Unleashed, there was the PS3 and Xbox 360 version, and then there was a very different Nintendo Wii version that was built from the ground up for that device. There were also games like, do you remember Sonic and the Secret Rings that Ogawa-san led?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That was like an auto runner. And it was more about like just using the limitations and strengths of the Wii controller to give kind of a motion control experience to Sonic that felt very unique. There was the Sonic the Black Knight one as well. Again, all experiences that you'd have to have Nintendo hardware to enjoy. And then during the Wii U era, even though that was a challenging console, got a bunch of exclusive Sonic games. There was Sonic the Lost World, which was the one run by Sonic Team, and we had a Western-produced Sonic Boom, which maybe the less said about the better on that one, but was interesting that those never came to any other platforms. And what was particularly interesting is that that time, the 3DS games were actually the ones that sold the best. So there was a Lost World and a Sonic Boom set of 3DS games that were completely different from the Wii U games, but those are the ones that at the time were easier to get into players' hands because people had more 3DSs.
Yep, there are a lot more of those consoles out there for sure. I wonder if we would have seen those games percolate to other consoles if they had sold more, or if the Wii U had sold more.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Interesting also that the way we found the team that did the Sonic Boom Fire and Ice, for instance, that was a team called Sanzaru, who ended up making new Sly Cooper game for Sony. And we're just kind of those rare experts in the action platform space. They were, I remember, very, very excited to get a chance to work on a Sonic game. And the ambitions of Sonic Boom are considerable as well, even if the end product didn't turn out to be spectacular. Remember, there was an entire Cartoon Network show that was spun off of that release.
Yeah, short-lived, but there was.
Yeah. So just looking to the future, Switch 2, I think, is going to be a great home now for a lot of the Atlus games. So
definitely.
For the longest time, we've seen Atlus games kind of hit on the PlayStation platforms and then take forever to get over to Switch. I'm guessing, especially with Metaphor ReFantazio coming so quickly into Xbox, that you're going to see day and date releases more likely with things like Persona on the Nintendo Switch, which would be fantastic. They've always led with like the Shin Megami Tensei games. Of course, we'll see whatever the next big Sonic game ends up being, whether he's in a car or whether he's running independently, is going to be focused on Nintendo first. And I would say that if you're a Sega fan, Switch 2 is probably going to be, over time, a must-have.
I agree. I think Sega and Nintendo have a very, very tight relationship, and I wouldn't be surprised to see maybe more interesting tie-ups downstream or as we move into the console's launch and beyond. So maybe that's the fanboy me hoping, and maybe the reality is that in order to get ROI on your development, you have to be on all these different consoles. But I would like to think that the relationship is still so close and good that there will be some kind of unique experiences available for Switch 2 owners.
Well, one thing that's definitely going to carry over that I already get tremendous value out of with Switch 1 is the Nintendo Switch Online, the Genesis service.
For sure.
That is really great. You have, I think, 50 games now that are Genesis games and a lot of the hits. And if you're investigating that, one thing I cannot recommend enough is to go to the Nintendo store online and pick up one of their authentic Genesis controllers. Because it's so much fun to play those games, and there's something about holding that physical controller, the three buttons, that feels exactly like it did when you were a kid in the 90s, that brings you back to that experience. It's really, really fantastic. The lineup is great too. They have your Streets of Rages, the Sonic games, Phantasy Star 4, which I've been playing recently, and also little known and seen hits like Rystar, which is fun to experiment with, gain ground, some stuff from Treasure, and just really you can tell that the people who are choosing those games understand the catalog very well, understand what fans want. And I will say, if anything, my big hope, and I know it's hard to do, but boy, wouldn't it be cool if they could extend Nintendo Switch Online to include Saturn.
Huh.
Get some Saturn games out there.
That is a large dream, a large wish, and maybe it will come to pass. My understanding is that the Saturn is extremely difficult to emulate, but that is not to say impossible.
It's been 30 years.
It has been.
So that I think would be kind of the neatest cherry on top. If we're getting GameCube, it would be really neat if we could at least get that. And if we're getting GameCube, why not Dreamcast as well? That might be easier.
Dreamcast I would expect to see before Saturn, to be honest. So I would not be surprised to see that start to come out.
Yep. Well, I think that kind of covers off what we're looking for and hoping for the future. Any last thoughts, Chris?
I want to throw reverse on the time machine a little bit and tell me about your early days. Were you Team Genesis or Team SNES?
Oh, that's a good question. So I was one of the very rare kids that got to be Team both.
Wow.
That started in the 8-bit days. So I had an 8-bit Nintendo. I remember when those were impossible to find, my dad said, "Do you want to get a Sega Master System instead?" But I was a kid who had gotten an Odyssey 2 instead of an Atari. And I remembered how painful it was to know that my friends were playing Zaxxon and Donkey Kong and Pac-Man, and I didn't have any of that. So I held firm to get a Nintendo. But eventually, I had played at my friend's house's Sega Master System and was like, I want both. I want to be able to access both. So there was a Christmas where I got the Sega Master System with Double Dragon and Thunderblade, and ended up getting like Rocky and Rambo and Shinobi and Phantasy Star and some other cool stuff too. But that early in made me a fan of both. So when the 16-bit era came, I ended up getting Genesis first. I was working at Dairy Queen and saved for months to get my first Genesis with the Altered Beast pack-in, right when they were saying, hey, you can get the Altered Beast pack-in and by mail, we'll send you a free copy of Sonic the Hedgehog. And I was like, I'm in, right? That was great. And then eventually, a couple months later, I left my Dairy Queen job for Software Etc., where I could get a discount on Super Nintendo. So I got that as well.
Feed the habit.
Yeah, yeah. So what about you? Which were you down the middle or favoring one?
I kind of started as a Nintendo fanboy. I had very fond memories of playing the NES when I would babysit for a certain couple. And they would call my parents and arrange for the babysitting gig, and I would eagerly await for that Friday night to roll around and fire up the console and play hours, you know, put the kid to bed as soon as possible so I could spend hours playing 1943, Excitebike, Xevious, just all these amazing games on the NES. And so it was the best gig a kid could have as far as I was concerned. And then I remember one time they came home and they had tied one on. They were pretty tipsy. And I think the woman actually barfed into the washing machine while I was kind of waiting for them to take me home, basically. Hopefully the guy wasn't drunk, but we'll, who knows.
You're still around.
I'm still around. So they never asked me back. And because I think they were so embarrassed about that whole thing, and I didn't really think anything of it. I was just like ready to go home, whatever. But at the time, I thought that I had done something wrong, and I was bummed that I didn't get to play the game anymore. So wah, wah. Of course, there'll be other times that I could play the NES. But I did think that that kind of formative experience turned me into a Nintendo fanboy. I had the SNES, and I had a Nintendo 64, and so many great gaming memories on all of those consoles.
Oh, absolutely. I remember the first game that made me really, really want a Genesis, actually. I was visiting grandparents, and they were near a video rental store that rented out Genesis machines.
Nice.
And so that wasn't a thing where I live, so I begged my dad, and he said, yeah, fine. And so we rented Mickey Mouse Castle of Illusion, which I just thought looked so much better than the Mario games. It didn't play as well, but it just was so good looking and played well enough on its own to make me really, really want that. So future times visiting grandma and grandpa, I'd be excited because then I could finally try Strider and I could try the Batman game based on the movie, which was very different than the NES game.
Yeah.
So super excited when I finally did own a Sega Genesis. And it did help me. It gave me an edge along with having a pool in our backyard of having friends come over and have my place be the place
you
to go.
You were the coolest kid on the block, man.
That's right. Golden Axe, baby.
Yeah. I was turned on to Genesis by a buddy of mine. He had one, and we would play Sonic for hours. We played NHL. We probably played NHL more than anything because it was so much fun as a two-player game playing against each other.
Oh, yeah.
Road Rash was really fun, too.
Road Rash was the best,
And there, it really hit me because there was an edge to the system that Nintendo lacked, and I think they did a really good job of both producing content that was differentiated and also just the marketing campaigns to really underscore the difference between the Genesis and what Nintendo. You know, Sega has what Nintendo don't is the famous ad campaign. So that really started me on the path of becoming more interested in Sega, and I'm obviously happy that I worked there, and I'm glad to see that both companies are thriving today.
Oh, yeah. And back at that time, it was a really unique thing for me to be working at a software, et cetera, because especially during like Black Fridays, seeing that there was literally just a 50-50 split between which machines people would get. And we'd have Sonic and Mario in the kiosks to show off what each machine could do. And actually, I always thought that Sonic looked better, was technically more sophisticated. And at the time, it was Sonic 2. So really was a beautiful game that ran super fast. And you put that next to Super Mario World, and you're going to get more Genesis sales, actually.
Yeah, yeah. They definitely were differentiated. They felt different. They played different. And it was interesting to kind of see the different audiences gravitate towards different platforms. And they were pretty equal in terms of market share. Sega did a great job of eating into Nintendo's market share, and I would say that they probably in the West won the 16-bit round or phase.
Yeah.
Of course, they eventually got pushed out of the console biz, but as we've seen, Sonic and company have survived and thrived and are building a nice transmedia empire. Nintendo, of course, it was and remains a behemoth, and they've been able to do things their own way, which I think gamers really appreciate. That authenticity rings especially true to Nintendo fans, and they got legions of ride-or-die fans as a result.
Yeah, and again, as we discussed earlier, a lot of the Sega fans of yore were ultimately Nintendo fans as well. And so it just kind of speaks to an era. If you're in your 40s or 50s, you grew up with the 16-bit wars, and you either were super lucky like me and had both machines, or you had one and really kind of were excited to try the other when you were at your friend's house.
Yeah, Yeah, it made for sleepovers and the like, I think.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And so, yeah, it was a special time. And again, back during those 16-bit days, it would have been impossible to think of them as allies. But now we can't think of them really as anything other than that. And I think that's really where it's best because, you know, I am really happy that I can get all of the best Sega games and don't have to buy another new console just for the privilege.
Yeah, yeah, it's great. Like you said, I think it's those contentious times are a reflection of an earlier time where platform was so important. It was a differentiator, part of a gamer's identity, really. You know, I'm a Nintendo person. I'm a Sega person. And you see that increasingly less these days, where in an age where platform matters less and games are more and more available everywhere. Nintendo, of course, is the exception, which is remarkable, I think. And while their ecosystem is the place to find their storied IP, it's nice that their walls have become increasingly open to visitors like Sega.
For sure. And if you go to Target and you go to the vintage tea section, the game brands that are represented are always going to be, first and foremost, either Mario or Sonic.
Yep, can't keep them down.
That's right. All right, well, I would love to know, for anyone listening, what your favorite game console was in the 16-bit era. Were you a ride-or-die Sega fan, or were you more on the Nintendo side? And with Switch 2 coming out, what Sega games are you interested in, if any? Are you more of a Puyo Pop Tetris person, or are you excited about Yakuza, or maybe Sonic?
Yeah, share your memories with us. Hit us at info@gamesasapodcast.com, and we will love to hear from you. Feedback, welcome, and as always, we appreciate you listening.